All right, anyone caught talking doesn't get dessert now. We're going to conclude today's very, I think, productive series of presentations and discussions with a Washington superstar on Asia, Matthew Goodman. Matthew is now a managing director at Stonebridge International, LLC. Before that, he worked with me in the National Security Council as the director for Asian Economic Affairs. Before joining the NSC, Matthew was at Goldman Sachs. He headed the investment bank's government affairs in Tokyo and also in London from 97 to 2002 and worked in the Treasury Department before that. He served as the financial attaché in Tokyo. I believe your predecessor was Tim Geithner, right? He cleaned up the mess Geithner made. Matthew and I were both at SAIS together. We were the entire advanced Japanese language class at SAIS. Matthew's Senmon Yogo, he knew all the Chinese characters for inflation-adjusted bond markets and stuff, and I knew all the nuclear weapons and security stuff, so we helped each other get through Japanese. Matthew played a key role on the Obama campaign as an unpaid advisor on Asia and also as on the State Department transition team. Matthew is not speaking for the Obama administration or the transition team or the Bush administration, all of which he served ably. We're going to ask him to speak about 20 minutes, and then he, I believe, will be happy to take your questions, except for this table here where I think we scared him with our lunch discussion. Thank you, Matthew.
Thank you, Mike. And thank you to CSIS and to Jetro for inviting me here today. I wasn't able to hear the whole morning discussion, but I heard part of it at the end, and I thought it was extremely rich and interesting. And I'm not sure I have anything additional to say, but I'll try to say it differently so it sounds interesting. I'm fighting a very bad cold that I picked up from my 11-year-old, so I'm going to just have some water at the ready. So we live in a time when old certainties are crumbling around us. For example, all of the following used to be things that one could say with a high degree of certainty. The market always produces optimal economic outcomes. Japanese exports will never fall by 50% in a single month. AIG is just a boring old insurance company. And an old favorite of mine as a lifetime Baltimore Orioles fan, no team with the word Sox in it will ever win the World Series. Okay, fair enough, that one crumbled some time ago, but still rankles. But seriously, in these unsettling times, it's natural to look around for things that are certain. And as I was thinking about today's seminar, one certainty came to mind clearly, which is that America's economic destiny is inextricably linked to that of its partners across the Pacific. The global economic crisis has put to rest any notion of decoupling between the U.S. and Asian economies. When America sneezes, Asia really does catch a cold. While Asian banks were relatively insulated from the first round effects of the financial crisis, our economic downturn has had severe repercussions for Asian economies by depriving them of robust markets to sell into. Asia's plight, in turn, deprives us of export markets that had been growing quite strongly in recent years, further constraining our growth. This negative feedback loop highlights the downside of our interdependence with Asia. Frankly, we Asianists, if there is such a term, tend to focus almost exclusively on the benefits of that interdependence, which are substantial: an expanding economic pie, greater efficiency and productivity, and ultimately enhanced stability and security for all sides. Yet we typically ignore or downplay the risks. Some of these risks are inevitable. When economies are as intertwined as those of the Asia-Pacific, problems that affect one of us affect all of us, just as I caught my cold from my son, unavoidably. But some risks are the result of government policies on both sides of the Pacific that have created unhealthy imbalances in our economic relations. Most importantly, policies in this country have for too long put too much emphasis on stimulating consumption, too little on encouraging saving, while the reverse is generally true on the other side of the Pacific. The current crisis underscores the fact that governments will have to adjust our policies to address these imbalances and reduce the risks of interdependence. It won't be easy to change old habits, but the good news is that nothing focuses the mind like a crisis. So rather than harp on the negative, I'd like to focus my remarks today on the opportunities that the current crisis presents for greater collaboration to build a more solid foundation for our shared long-term vision of Asia-Pacific integration. A discussion of Asia-Pacific integration usually focuses on an alphabet soup of institutions, APEC versus ARF versus EAS, and questions of who should be in or out and so forth. I will discuss institutional questions in a moment, but I want to start with the opportunities to take forward the substantive economic agenda between the United States and Asia. And I'll start in a strange place. On the very first day of my very first economics class in high school, over 30 years ago, the teacher described the major shortcoming of barter as a basis for economic activity, namely that it requires a so-called coincidence of wants between the two sides. Your five animal hides must be as valuable to me as my pile of rocks is to you. And by the way, this was an economics class, not an anthropology class. But the reason my teacher obviously made this point was to explain why money developed as a means of exchange. Yet between the United States and Asia, there really is a coincidence of wants, or at least a neat complementarity of interests in our economic relationship. Let me cite three core examples. As the U.S. government gets ready to issue an expected $1.7 trillion in marketable treasuries in 2009 to finance our deficits, we clearly need continued Asian investment in that paper. Brad Setzer at the Council on Foreign Relations recently estimated that foreign central banks bought some $600 billion in treasuries in 2008, with China alone accounting for nearly half of that. With foreign reserve accumulation tapering off, Setzer estimates that total central bank purchases could fall to only $450 billion in 2009, still a very large number even by today's standards. So clearly we want, or rather need, Asian capital. For their part, Asians need a place to invest their massive foreign exchange reserves, and frankly, there is little realistic alternative to the United States at the moment, so they want to know their investments here are safe and generate a realistic return, a reasonable return. This means, in essence, that they want the United States to, A, lower the risks in our financial system by bolstering bank capital, dealing with toxic assets, addressing regulatory gaps, and so on, and to B, to restore our economy to a healthy growth trajectory, thereby bringing interest rates off their current floor. So U.S. and Asian interests, or wants, clearly coincide in this critical area. A second example. As revealed by the growing chorus of concern about rising protectionism in the U.S., which I understand we heard about earlier, although I wasn't unfortunately here for Bruce's presentation, Asians want continued access to U.S. markets. We want market access in Asia too, of course, but the corresponding want here is really access to Asian domestic demand, in particular personal consumption. As the U.S. government has long pointed out, consumption accounts for an unusually low share of GDP in most major Asian economies, just 36% in China compared to around 70% in the United States. At a time when Americans are unable to be the world's consumers of last resort, we need Asians to pick up some of the slack. This means we need Asian governments to adopt consumption-oriented stimulus packages at home. They need this, too, since with the U.S. and Europe in recession, they will be less able to rely on export-led growth in any case. In this regard, it is encouraging to see the world's second and third largest economies, Japan and China, announcing large fiscal stimulus packages equivalent to several percent of GDP, even after accounting gimmicks, and apparently considering further such measures. Beyond the cyclical boost, I believe, governments in those and other Asian countries should adopt an array of structural policies over time to move their economies to a more consumption-driven model. This is a topic worthy of its own seminar, but my basic point here is that the American and Asian desires for access to each other's demand are a second important pair of complementary wants. Third, at a more abstract but no less important level, Asians want a greater voice in global affairs and more power in the international institutions that were established predominantly by the Western powers. Asian countries, as everyone knows, are underrepresented in the Bretton Woods institutions, the IMF, the World Bank, and so on. And there is only one Asian country, Japan, in the G7, G8 forums, which together have effectively served as the steering group for the global economy for over 30 years. In response, Americans say, or have recently come to say, okay, we're willing to talk about rebalancing power in these institutions, but in exchange, Asians should take more responsibility for global governance, whether supporting the international trading system, making a greater contribution to global development, or tackling the effects of climate change. Many of those issues, in particular climate change, I know were discussed earlier. Again, these are subjects for several separate seminars, but suffice it to say here that the Asian desire for voice and the U.S. desire for shared responsibility coincide increasingly and quite neatly. So as these examples have shown, and there are others, and with a nod to my high school economics teacher, I would argue that the coincidence of wants between the United States and Asia is so strong that barter might actually be possible. Or put another way, there may be the basis for a grand bargain here. The term grand bargain has been thrown around a lot lately, especially in the context of the upcoming G20 meetings in London, by everyone from British Prime Minister Gordon Brown to Morris Goldstein of the Peterson Institute in an interesting recent op-ed. The idea is a bit simplistic, of course. There isn't really a single comprehensive fix to all our immediate and long-term problems. But I do think there is an opportunity in the midst of the current crisis for the United States and its major Asian partners to move toward a multifaceted understanding that satisfies the bundle of complementary wants on both sides that I just described. The U.S. would work to fix its domestic financial problems, put its economy back on a solid growth path, keep its markets open, and share more power in international institutions, while Asia would stimulate domestic consumption, both in a cyclical and structural sense, keep buying our treasuries, and make a more constructive contribution to global challenges such as trade, development, and climate change. Easier said than done, of course. Each of these elements is difficult for any of us to deliver on politically. But again, I think the present crisis, by highlighting the risks and galvanizing political will on all sides, creates a unique opportunity to move toward the broad outlines of this kind of deal. The result could be a win-win for all of us, enhancing our prosperity, security, and sense of partnership. Whereas without progress on these elements, I question whether long-term economic integration in the Asia-Pacific region is sustainable or even achievable. So how do we make this grand bargain a reality? Well, clearly not by shaking hands over a round of golf at a resort in Hawaii. As I mentioned before, there is no single comprehensive agreement that can pull together all the strands of the bargain, nor is there a single institution through which it can be negotiated. Instead, it will require a multifaceted conversation with our Asian partners through a range of institutions at different levels, multilateral, regional, plurilateral, by which I mean small groupings of countries, and bilateral. A number of these institutions are already discussing key elements of the bargain, and the challenge is to tie all these strands together while stepping up the intensity of the discussions. At the multilateral level, the issue of shares and chairs, i.e. rebalancing international representation, is being discussed within the IMF and World Bank and other institutions, while the G20 is working on strengthening coordination of macroeconomic and financial policies. Asian voices and interests feature prominently in all of these discussions. Meanwhile, we are working on many elements of the grand bargain in our bilateral dialogues with key Asian partners, notably Japan and China. I'll come back to Japan in a moment, but as you know, on her recent trip to China, Secretary of State Clinton proposed an updated version of the strategic economic dialogue in which economic security and other issues would be discussed. I hope and expect that this new dialogue will seek to make progress on the key strands of the bargain. Stimulus, financial reform, market opening, cooperation on global challenges like climate change and development, and so on. Personally, I think creative plurilateral approaches can also be a promising way to move forward on many of the elements of the bargain. And this is my personal view. One example is the Asia-Pacific Partnership on Clean Development and Climate, launched by the Bush administration with six Asia-Pacific partners, Japan, China, Korea, Australia, India, and Canada. In addition to the specific objectives of improving energy efficiency, promoting best practices, and developing new low-emission solutions, this kind of initiative can build a more solid foundation for sustainable growth in the Asia-Pacific region and help encourage habits of leadership on a major global challenge. Another interesting plurilateral approach I would mention here is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the trade agreement signed by four APEC countries, Chile, Singapore, New Zealand, and Brunei, onto which the U.S. announced its intention to, last year to dock. Pushing a proactive trade agenda, again, as you heard this morning, is difficult in an economic downturn, but trying to keep the bicycle moving forward by engaging with a small, like-minded group of countries strikes me as a realistic way to proceed. And then there is APEC, an institution that would charitably have to be called underappreciated in this town and many others. The flaws of APEC are abundant, but the forum does bring together a group of countries that represent roughly half of world GDP and trade. It is the only forum where Asia-Pacific leaders, including the U.S. president, regularly meet. And it has done useful work in promoting economic integration at both the operational and aspirational levels. Particularly with the trajectory of upcoming APEC hosts, Singapore this year, Japan next, and the U.S. in 2011, I think there is great scope for using this forum to advance key elements of the grand bargain and build the foundations for a more integrated Asia-Pacific community. It's important to stress that none of the institutions I've mentioned preempts or takes precedence over the others. In fact, there's a natural continuum of effort required from the G20 meeting next month to the G8 summit in July to APEC in the fall to key bilateral dialogues throughout the year. That's not me, is it? No. Good. That's always embarrassing when you're speaking. Which brings me to U.S.-Japan relations. Clearly, close collaboration between the two largest economies in the region is essential to advancing any form of Asia-Pacific grand bargain or longer-term economic integration. Yet we have to be frank and admit that given the serious economic and political distractions on both sides, it will be difficult in the short run for Tokyo and Washington to fully leverage their strong partnership to exercise joint leadership across the array of challenges I've listed here. Realistically, I think we're going to have to pursue a more targeted approach in which we pick up a few key issues that play to our joint strengths and on which tangible progress can be made in the relatively short term. My own list would include promoting energy efficiency in the region, agreeing on a joint approach to climate change, and exploring creative new approaches to global development. At the same time, we should continue to consult and collaborate through bilateral and multilateral institutions, as we have for many years, on other challenges such as macroeconomic stimulus, financial reform, trade liberalization. I think the Obama administration, and I'm biased, of course, has made a good start in signaling its commitment to the U.S.-Japan alliance through the early trips by Secretary Clinton to Tokyo and Prime Minister Aso to Washington, among other things. I'm also encouraged by the fact that notwithstanding Japan's current economic and political challenges, there remains a strong reservoir of goodwill in Japan, both among elites and ordinary citizens, towards the United States and our alliance. This provides a solid platform on which to work together on the economic challenges we face today and on building a more integrated region in the future. So in conclusion, as I said at the start, these are sobering times which require us to revisit old assumptions and certainties. This doesn't mean we should abandon important objectives of which greater Asia-Pacific economic cooperation is clearly one. But I do think it means we need to focus on developing policies on all sides that will both promote interdependence and mitigate its risks. Hence, my discussion of a grand bargain between the United States and its Asian partners and the institutions to in which to talk about that. Key to all this will be a real and sustained American commitment to engagement with the Asia-Pacific region. This is something that the last several administrations have shared, but I think the arrival of a new administration with a mandate for change provides a new opportunity to refresh that commitment and exercise creative and energetic leadership in the region. The really good news is that Asians seem to be yearning for this kind of engagement and leadership from the United States. If I may end with a shameless plug for our host and moderator, this point was confirmed most recently by the survey of elite opinion in Asia conducted by this esteemed institution under Mike's direction. One of the most telling results of that study, in my view, was that some 80% of Chinese respondents said it was important or very important to have active U.S. participation in East Asian community building. So we're starting with some strong assets, and I hope and expect a period of solid progress ahead towards sustainable Asia-Pacific integration. Thank you. I am happy to take questions. Please.
My name is Hal Saunders. I'm Hal Saunders from the Kettering Foundation. My question is prompted by your recent service on the NSC staff and my earlier service of 13 years on that staff way back. So I'm thinking of that perspective. You've outlined a very attractive grand strategy for reaching a grand bargain. It's multifaceted. It's many actors and so on. Where in the present administration or any administration would you find the mind at work to keep that strategy in view and in play over a vast multitude of interactors, if you will? It's mind-boggling. It's terribly important. Your strategy is very attractive. But how can you do it? How can we do it?
That's a very good question and allows me to make a plug for another CSIS report that actually I had some responsibility for putting out last fall on crafting Asian economic dialogues. And we went through and looked at some of the dialogues that had been done in the past, or strategies that have been pursued in the economic area in Asia, and came up with, I think it was 14 lessons learned from those experiences, which included everything from the Structural Impediments Initiative with Japan to the SED with China and others. And lesson six, I believe, was that the White House needs to be early and consistently involved in driving and monitoring keeping everyone honest in the process going forward. So I think, you know, the NSC, I mean, that's what the NSC was in a sense designed for, and this is another application. Obviously, there's the NEC-NSC distinction nowadays, which wasn't there presumably when you were there. But that's a sort of technicality that can be worked out as long as you have the right people at the table. So I think the White House has to be the one driving the big bargain and, you know, the specific elements of it, or you know, overseeing it and making sure that everybody is keeping their strands going. But then operationally, you know, the agencies have very good people, some of them in this room, who are very experienced at doing these sorts of dialogues on the various aspects that I discussed. And they don't really need day-to-day monitoring or supervision. They're very used to doing these things. I think it's just a question of oversight and coordination from the White House. And then you have, you know, Treasury doing its thing, USTR doing its thing, State doing its piece. And I think it's, you know, it's within the reach of the human mind to, you know, come up with a structure that works and keeps that going. I mean, I think there's another point, though, which is that it is hard at the NSC, as you know, to keep a focus both on the long-term and the immediate fires that you're putting out, because that's in practice what you spend a lot of your day doing. And that is a challenge. But there have been various suggestions and ideas, and I don't know whether the Obama administration is going to implement any of these to allow for some space and bandwidth to discuss longer-term strategic questions. But that's that is a challenge. So, anybody else? Yes.
Mr. Goodman, I'm Richard Cronin from the Stimson Center here in Washington. I wonder if you could expand on something more substantive. That is, you talk about the synergy or complementary, et cetera, between the U.S. economy and East Asian economies, especially China these days. But what actually do you think are the prospects that China will continue to generate the surpluses in the near term required to keep buying treasury bills and completing that investment loop? And what would the implications for all of our plans here for recovery, both in U.S. and Asia, if that doesn't happen? Because I do think there's a real prospect that that's not going to happen the way we hope it will. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think you've highlighted one of the risks of the current environment and the risks of our the imbalances that have been created over many years in our economic relations. I mean, I'm not a China economic analyst per se, so I can't tell you what's going to happen to the Chinese economy. I'm not sure anybody knows. There are some pretty gloomy forecasts of what not only is going to is happening, but is going to happen in China, and that is a source of concern on a number of levels. One of which you've highlighted. As I mentioned, again, according to Brad Setzer, who's one of the smartest human beings I've ever encountered, not that he's necessarily right, but has estimated that foreign central bank purchases are going to decrease, they'll remain at a high level, and that gap is going to have to be made up by private investors of one kind or another. How all that is going to play out is very difficult to predict. But I think it highlights the importance of our continuing to work together with the Chinese and others to ensure that economic growth does continue around the world or pick up again. I probably won't go any further than that. As a former Treasury guy, there's a kind of chip implanted that you can only go so far in talking about those issues. Thanks. Yes.
Thank you. Urata, Waseda University, Tokyo. I'd like to know U.S. Attitude or view toward East Asian regionalism, more specifically East Asian Summit. If I understand correctly, there are three conditions that you have to meet to become a member of East Asian Summit. That is to sign TAC, Treaty on Amity and Cooperation, and then dialogue partner with ASEAN, and substantial involvement with ASEAN countries. And if I understand correctly, Mrs. Clinton indicated that she's interested in signing TAC, and that will give all the three conditions to be satisfied the U.S. And I wonder if U.S. is interested in joining East Asia Summit. So that's the question I'm going to ask you.
Well, I don't know the answer to that since I don't represent the Obama administration. I don't know what their position is going to be ultimately on that, but I can say that, I mean, first of all, I confirm that my understanding as well is that Secretary Clinton did express an interest in signing the TAC, which is one of the conditions for the ES, but it doesn't necessarily mean that means that they are on a trajectory to join the EAS. They're different. That would be one possible direction to go. Another would be to be able to participate in EAS events on a more ad hoc basis. And to coordinate more with EAS. I think that this whole question of architecture is a very complex one with a lot of different strands. And I think that my guess is that this is a topic that is going to be part, the EAS question in particular, is going to be part of a broader conversation that will start, my guess is, pretty soon within the U.S. government, if it hasn't already, about what sort of architecture the new administration wants to support, particularly in the run-up to the APEC host year in 2011, which does provide a an opportunity for a sort of a high visibility initiative of some kind. But my guess is that, particularly without many of the key officials in place, that there hasn't been significant discussion of how all of that's going to play out and what they feel about it. I mean, I guess my own, just backing up a little bit about EAS and when it arose, I'm sort of more relaxed about, because I think maybe embedded in your question was the question of, you know, the U.S. seeing these East Asian forums develop and being perhaps concerned about not being part of it. I think, you know, that I'm sort of more relaxed about that. Every region and, you know, narrowly defined region of East Asia, excluding its Pacific partners, naturally, you know, wants to get together and talk about certain kinds of issues. And I think we have similar, you know, Western Hemisphere arrangements, and Europe has them, and others do. So that's sort of on some level a natural phenomenon. I think it's a question of whether, you know, when we get to talking about broad issues that affect, you know, the broader Asia-Pacific region in which the U.S. has a clear interest, you know, we want to be, I think, part of that for our own reasons. And so I do think that whether the EAS is the right forum for us is, I think, a question to be determined. But I think that, in general, there are going to be some forums that we want to be part of and some that we don't need to be. And I think that all of those questions are going to be addressed once the senior officials are in place and they've had a chance to kind of think about this holistically. One more? Any more? Good.
That was terrific. Thanks very much, Matthew. That's a great way to wrap up the discussion. You saved me one of my bullets here, which was to plug our survey. But if you would like to see our survey, it'll be available online. It is available online. We surveyed over 300 strategic thinkers on Asian integration across Asia. And the findings are consistent with many of our discussions today, but a lot of data if you're interested. We'll also have the PowerPoint presentations that you saw today available online. I think most of them are in your packets. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Ari, we also are going to have this as a podcast on CSIS if you want to come back and watch the entire thing tonight. We're going to ask Hayashi-san to... yeah, if you can't sleep, that's right. We're going to ask Hayashi-san to close things, but let me quickly thank the interpreters. Thank you very much, guys. The team from JETRO that came in with Hayashi-san and helped us to do this. Thank you. Ari Hirano and the CSIS team. Thanks, guys. Nick Sancheni at the Japan Chair did a lot of the work for this. He's at home with his new baby girl. He rejected my proposal that he name her JETRO in honor of the... I think JETRO Sancheni is a great name, but... so he, by remote, deserves our thanks. And, of course, very much to Hayashi-san for his leadership. And, Hayashi-san, if you would bring us to a close, I'll turn the mic over to you. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Michael Green, and thank you all the guests, distinguished guests and the distinguished speakers. I really appreciate, as representing JETRO, that we could hold this distinguished meeting today in cooperation with CSIS. And this is the fourth meeting, but I think because the world is changing very rapidly, the themes and discussions change very, always changes, but it's always important and to remind the American distinguished guests of what is happening in the East Asian part of the world and what we would like to learn, what is happening in the United States. But at the moment, the U.S. government is now on the process of shaping the final structure. But anyway, this is really a valuable opportunity for all of us to be able to have a dialogue, very vivid dialogue, and I appreciate and I thank all the speakers who made an excellent presentation and very profound presentation, including Mr. Goodman, who just spoke a very interesting and insightful views. I appreciate very much. And I finally thank all the people who helped us, our activities today, interpreters and CSSI staff and the JETRO staff as well. And I would like to hold the similar or the same sort type of meeting, a continuous meeting next year and the year after next. Thank you very much indeed.